Good morning. How is everybody? Thank you for getting up early and coming. I'm Carol Choksi, and what we're going to do is just try to get through our presentations as quick as we can. I have Joan Decker and Phil Banton, two eminences of our field, and I'm going to let Joan go first.
Good morning, everyone. It's very nice to be here. Thank you for coming here this morning so early again. I wanted to give a little bit of a different perspective on authenticity. My name is Joan Decker. I serve as the Records Commissioner in the City of Philadelphia, and the Records Department has many different parts to it, but I think what affects and it relates to what we're doing here this morning is to tell you that we are responsible for City Government Archives, City of Philadelphia Government Archives, and we also have a number of operational areas, including land records and mapping, among many other things. I wanted to give you a perspective on GIS. The city implemented a GIS system in the 90s. And what we've done is taken a series of departments that converted a lot of paper information into an electronic full-blown geographic information system. So I'm quickly going to go through this and, of course, afterwards, happy to answer any questions. Again, there was a timeline. GIS depends on the level of accuracy that you want to achieve as to what you do. The city invested a lot of money and time into this initiative over many different city agencies, city planning, records department, streets department, water department. And what this involved was actually creating an understanding who had very accurate formal levels of accuracy. The city planning had the overall design, big picture idea, whereas the records department has very specific and accurate parcel data. We went through, as you can see, the timeline. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but it was a very extensive project with orthophotography, a flight over to get the actual coordinates in the real world and attach all the information from the various city departments to that ortho information. This is what a parcel map looks like. Any of you who own a home may not realize it, but there is something called a legal description, and all of those little lines and areas really represent the dimensions of the land portion of the property that you own, and it's referred to as the parcel base layer in GIS terms. It includes the dimensions, it includes a starting point, it includes a directional arrow, which you could see at the top of the map, with a lot of other information, a unique number for every parcel and map, as well as we call it annotation, which means the actual dimensions of a property as well as its starting point. What we encountered when we converted over 4,800 paper maps in the paper world, which are engineering accurate maps, we wanted to retain the accuracy. And we know that on some of the paper maps there was overlap. The same parcel may have been depicted twice because you wanted to show an adjacent area. If you look to the right, you can see how the city agencies all communicate with one another, so we know how to exchange data. And that was organizing the city in tiles, what is known as tiles, so we could exchange it. There were three maps, as you can see to the left, that actually contained overlapping of similar parcels. So in a GIS world, as we converted it, they could only be in one location. So we had to organize the project in such a way that we got absolutely accurate information, not only from the engineering accurate maps, but also in the conversion activity as we went to the GIS system. Now, if you look to, you're going to see coming in from the right, you can see that. So here are the three maps. We knew where they were located. So we see one map. We have another map coming in with overlap. As you can see, the parcels are overlapping. And then the third map is coming in. So our job was really, again, to maintain the accuracy. We are talking about authenticity. We wanted to preserve the engineering accurate dimensions, but we wanted to make sure that everything fit within the space organized in the real world. And so this is the exercise that we went through. So we did this work. This is a very technical, high-level technical project, and we did this over a period of several years. Again, this is just another way of looking at the geo-referencing that took place. The red lines that you can see are actually curb lines. The curb lines are furnished in the GIS system. It's like the system in the city, every agency has a piece of information that they provide. The streets department, the survey group, provides curb lines and everything in the street, which is also used for routing and trash truck and trash pickup. But anyway, these curb lines actually represented dimensions in the real world, and what we did was layer and overlay the parcel data into that, of course, with the correct directional data and dimensions, and fit it into those curb lines so we knew exactly where in the real world these particular parcels were located. And this is just another way of looking at it, the way that the project was completed. So this rotation and fitting had to be done for every parcel on all of the maps. As I said, it's a very technical project. And the records department, because we have the parcel map, we were actually the base layer, considered the base layer in the city system. So anyone else that wants to attach their information to it will start with the base layer. You might envision all the pieces of information as we refer to it as the layers of an onion, where you're peeling back different layers that all fit together in the real world. This was the pre-edge matching, again, just another way to look at it. If you could look at the colors, you can see how it overlaps onto the different areas, blue and yellows. Again, we had to resolve all those differences to get them to come out accurately. And then post-edge matching, where you can see all of the colors are in their own space, or that is, all the parcels and the accurate parcels are in their own space. This one is took the paper maps and converted them. They were paper maps. They were scanned to a particular, for those of you who are familiar with these projects and technology, you look for a certain resolution, DPI, dots per inch. You want to have a certain level of accuracy. When you do a conversion, you're going to be converting your lines. In the electronic world, it's going to exist as electronic data, and you want to make sure that you can measure that and really retain accuracy. So if someone were looking at the electronic lines and trying to measure, they're going to get a pretty good representation of the dimensions of a particular property in the real world. And this is what the electronic lines, as we proceed, we took the scanned layer, which had a lot of the historical information, and we created applications where you can look at the scanned layer, the registry map, but any other changes that are taking place, and the conversion project actually converted the, I guess you would call them the dumb image lines, into using software into a smart, intelligent electronic lines, which then can be changed and manipulated over time to reflect changes in properties, whether it be due to subdivisions or consolidations. So this is really what the more recent layers of the GIS system look like. And this is showing you the intelligent digital lines overlaying on the scan maps. Again, we have various kinds of applications which enable you to view them and access the data in this way. And this is annotation. So this is what the lines look like without annotation. And again, when you pull the intelligent information out of the database and layer it over the visual representation. And again, all of this, the point of this is that the paper maps were engineering accurate maps. We did not want to lose the accuracy, yet we wanted to reflect and convert this in the real world using electronic data so that it was positioned according to the real world and everyone could refer to it, the other city agencies. And this is a way that we were able to maintain accuracy and, I guess you would say, authenticity of the data. And just another view of this. I wanted to present one other different, another application, if you want to help me get to this. This is another way of looking at it. The records department, we had a collection in the city archives of photographs that have been, I guess, started in the late 1860s. which were part of a public works project at the request of the law department, and continues to be so. And what it is a risk management tool. So as the water department, streets department went out and they photographed and did work, we have photographers who went and did a before and after during, so that a resident couldn't come to the city and sue, saying that, well, the streets or water department damaged my property. And as a result of that, we have this marvelous collection, which is also geo-referenced as well. It's, I think, the only collection that is available easily by location. So what we're showing here is some of our earlier maps. We're trying to show how we were able, if you envision today, how would we know today if a street name was changed or a location name was changed, where it exists in the real world today? It'd be very difficult. So what we were able to do using a number, here's an older map, and this is one of the street names, which was Merchant Street at a particular point in time, that was renamed later and became known as Ludlow Street. So what we did was, you can see where it's located. We created from various kinds of records that we had an historic index, which is available electronically along with our parcel maps and some other information with the photographs as well. This enables you to look through and go to a street name and then actually pull up the current street name, look at an older street name that where it formerly was, get a description of the location and any other information that was available. And what this enables us to do is, again, we pulled this information, various information, to create an electronic index. We pulled it from a lot of the land records, from early court and jury decisions, from court dockets, surveys from the streets department. And we had several ordinances that we were able to refer back to, ordinance passed by local city council, which, again, city council has the authority to rename streets, so all of this information was documented in those collections. So this enabled us to then pull up the photographs. This is one of the earlier photographs on East Market Street. If anyone's been in Philadelphia, it's right actually east of City Hall, looking down Market Street to the historic area. You can see it was really bustling activity there. If you look at the red block, another way, again, to get to authentic or accurate information, that red block at the bottom of the screen, it asks for a user, if they see any errors, to please report it to us. And so by virtue of doing this, we were able to identify some errors or we might say omissions in the data. So it's another way to enlist public participation to create and provide accurate and in some cases more full information. I think I'm running out of time, so I'm going to go through this very quickly. There were occasions where the information was not inaccurate, but people wanted to provide additional information. So anyone who's been to Philadelphia, this is the Cathedral, Basilica of St. Peter and Paul, Roman Catholic Church, located along Beautiful Parkway, and that is one of the Archdiocese residences, and this was black bunting, we were told, which we investigated and confirmed, which really was to mark the death of one of the very prominent archbishops in Philadelphia. So that was the way to add some annotation and background. This is another example using the photographs that are online in the Philly History website, where the location was not quite accurate, and you would be surprised how many really experts you have in the public. There were folks who really understood bridges, overpasses, and pipes, and they came to us and they could prove that this actually was a slightly different location in the same area of the city, but nonetheless a different location. So we were able to identify that. And this was actually the house that and a street that is no longer there. It was Noble Street. And anyone who's traveled through Philadelphia or using some of the interstate highways, this is I-95. All of this, these homes were torn down. So when we pulled this photograph up, and of course we did have an address on it, but we wanted to know exactly where in the real world it is, and using Google Maps, you can overlay this information, and we could determine that at a particular point in time that actually resided under I-95. So anyway, these are just a couple of different ways of as you approach the data and you're converting into the real world, just a couple of different ideas and thoughts about how you can approach this while maintaining whatever accurate level of accuracy that you need and also enriching the data and you know, still supporting the authenticity of the data that you're working with. Thank you.
Thank you. That was really neat. I appreciate that very much. I took copious notes. Our next speaker is Phil Banton, also from Indiana University Bloomington. He's our archivist. Phil, you're up next.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Phil Banton from Indiana University, director of the University Archives and Office of Records Management. I'm going to talk to you today about authenticity in electronic systems, information systems. We only have 15 minutes, so it's going to be a whirlwind. I'll make these slides. I've made a number of the slides available to people in paper form, but I don't have enough. So I'll anyone who wants one, please let me know, and I'll provide them with one electronically. This information I'm giving you is general, but it's based on real-life experience. I've been involved with electronic records, trying to develop electronic record systems since 1995 at IU, and have done audits of electronic systems. I serve on a group called the Data Stewards, and who looks at data and information enterprise-wide and plans and improves and so on. So I know what IU's doing, and I know what they're not doing. And I want to talk to you today about what the few things they are doing and then the things they're not doing, and do it in a unfortunately, pretty general way. First of all, authenticity. This is what I want to talk about briefly. Authenticity, just get the definition and its components down, what IU is doing, what it's not, and then what the archivist can do to better authenticate. Where can we add value? And that's where what are our strengths, and where do they fit into the needs of the institution in terms of record keeping? Don't lose your focus in all of this. I mean, there's a billion things we can do with these systems, but our job, we're record keepers, and we need to be focused on that and what that means. So authenticity, the way I define it in here and in my book and other places, is I use the ISO 15489 records management standard, and they talk about authenticity as being an implicit record value derived from a record that has reliability and integrity. If you look at what integrity is, we're talking about records that are protected from unauthorized and undocumented alteration and deletion. This is what we think of most often with authenticity. And what we're looking for is, how do we do that, right? How do we meet that test? And bottom line, what I found, and certainly what auditors have found on our campus and other institutions, it's about internal controls. It's about policies. It's about audit trail metadata. Why is there such an emphasis on metadata in the world? Well, one is certainly description of content, but increasingly this metadata has been used to document what we do, how we do it, why we do it. It's a trail. It's not just for us as managers, but it's also for the researcher of the future. So they can look at this thing and say, this is the original, at least that's what they're telling me. And we would provide audit trail metadata and other metadata to substantiate that. We would say that in the process of migrating, for example, no changes were made. We'd let them know that, so that 100 years from now, when somebody looks at this electronic document, they have pretty good sense that they're looking at an authentic or not authentic document. We're providing those clues. That's our responsibility. So you're going to hear, again, I'm going to about internal controls, metadata, establishing ways to to check what you do, to make sure it's done right, to provide a trail of that. Reliability refers to the authority and trustworthiness of the records as evidence. It's part of authenticity. It's about maintaining the identity of the record, its context, its provenance, the things that uniquely distinguish it. This is where metadata really comes to the fore, but it's also, again, about internal controls. It's about policies and procedures. A definition of internal controls: specified set of policies, procedure, activities designed to meet an objective. Control may exist within a design function or activity in a process. These are usually built into the system, and that's what we want to have happen. We want to be part of that planning process, so we can say, okay, we want to authenticate these things over time. How are we going to do that? Well, we'll begin to look at these internal controls, these audit trail metadata evidence that we will help build into these systems. Again, we won't do it. We're not technologists, but we will be there to say this has to be done if we're going to be able to authenticate this record over time. Here's what I think IU is doing rather well. They're doing a lot of things well, actually, but again, it's all really focused on short-term management. If you look at what institutions are doing around the country, at least the ones I'm familiar with, they spend a lot of time and resources on managing records, data, information in the first 5 years. That's where all the action is. Doesn't mean they don't have records with long-term value. They do, and they do take care of some of those very, very well. But there's a lot of information and records that an archivist, say, have long-term value that are sort of languishing out there because there's not a good management scheme. There aren't good internal controls anymore. There isn't audit trail metadata built in. So IU is focused a lot on that early active use stage and developing authentication procedures and controls, policies, audit trails, building that in at that early stage. So identity management, audit controls, documenting creation, accuracy, and the short-term management of data, and, of course, backup, which backup is definitely a way of is a strategy we can use to authenticate. But it has some limitations to its value long-term. So e-authentication, they've been doing that institutions for many, many years. We have to know, have procedures, controls for who's using the stuff. Are they authorized to use it? Are they authorized to revise it? This is a continuing battle with hackers and various ways people can get in. They're constantly refining, changing. Now they're doing this in terms of networks, federated systems. So in my case at Indiana, the Big Ten, the CIC, as they call the management group that surrounds those institutions, they're building a federated e-authentication process that will allow people from Indiana go into Ohio states and so on and so on. So these systems are getting more sophisticated, bigger, so on. They spend a lot of time on this. This is, and you can understand why. I mean, this is high-risk stuff. They've got to protect their data, their information. They have to get the right people in to do the work. So I go to data stewards meetings. This is what they talk about a lot. All kinds of stuff on this. And it's not unimportant, and we as archivists need it to be there. Data accuracy and quality. They spend a lot of time talking about making sure their data is accurate. And how do we do that? And they have validations, checks. They have internal controls to check that. They have manual controls to check it down the road. So accuracy is a very important part of the IU strategy to maintain authenticity. And then backups. They back up on a very regular schedule. They have all their systems on various schedules. They're not all on the same schedule. There's some more important things are backed up more frequently. But they do a good job with this on the whole. And it's important. Any management of a system has to have a backup system. But it, again, recognizes primarily for those situations where there's a disaster or there's a problem, you lose data, you need to recover it. It's not a long-term preservation strategy, as I'll talk about briefly in a moment. Okay, where are the weaknesses? I see there are a number of them, but here are three that I think are very important. Complete and accessible audit controls, particularly for long-term management. I mentioned before, I just don't think, I know, they're not thinking about functionality and building systems for long-term management, and that includes audit controls, and I'll get a little more specific on that in a minute. Metadata, documenting creation, use certain kinds of metadata on relationships between data is just not very full. It's not robust. It's very skeleton-like. If we want to reconstruct how a process evolved over time and see all the records of that process, we're going to have some difficulties with present-day systems. And then finally, well-developed preservation strategies for the future. This is just not happening. I mean, they migrate. Don't get me wrong. There are migrations going on, but there aren't resources in the same way that backup systems have resources to handle that. So audit controls, they're just not robust enough for records after 4 or 5 years. So what's not there? Well, they're not complete enough. We want to have audits every time a record is touched and changed or moved or transferred, something happens to it. We want something to say that this occurred and this was the result. That is, I mean, there's a limit to how much of that we can have, but we need to get in that business. This is where the archivist sits down and says, okay, for the longer term management, what additional audit trail metadata do we need? This is where you can really make a difference, and where I have made a difference. When I've helped auditors audit systems, I've more than once added audit trail metadata to the recommendations for modifications of that system. Automatically recorded. You don't want a lot of manual processes in any of these audit trail procedures. You want them to be very much automated. Unalterable and unscheduled. I found audit trails, which are, again, our snapshots, right? We don't want them to change. If there's going to be additional information added, it just gets layered on. I've found systems where they're going in and they're just modifying existing audits, audit trail information. I've found audit trails that aren't scheduled. So when the record that it described moves on or its disposition is permanent, the audit trail is set up to have a retention of 5 years. It disappears. These have to be, they're linked together. Now, remember, a lot of this audit trail information, most of it, is not part of the record. It'll be sitting in some kind of other database or somewhere else, and there'll be links, or should be links, that will connect the record content and the audit trail information. You've got to have those two travel through time together. If they're not, you got a problem. Readily accessible. Related, we want the user of the future and managers of the present to be able to pull up the content and then also see the audit trail information. You don't want that stuff, if it's separated, you don't want it to be a tremendous chore or you have to have special programming knowledge or have to have special information to get to it. It should be easily accessible that these things come together. So you see the record, you see the audit trail information, which tells you, okay, this is what happened to it over time, and you can, as a researcher, you can look at it and begin to determine how authentic this is, among other things, because it'll have authenticity information attached there, hopefully. Metadata. Here are some of the metadata pieces that I found as it relates to authenticity that are lacking. Record relationships. I still don't see in the United States very much in the way of linking records to function and activities. It just is something that's just not happening to the degree that it is in Europe. I was in Finland for 3 months and looked at some of their systems, and they're just routinely, everything's linked to functions and activities. We don't think about business processes enough, and that's a real problem in trying to understand our records in terms of a context. Record relationships, related records, there's just not enough metadata from what I've seen that shows this record's related to this record. We need to have metadata that does that. We need to say this was part of this process, or these records are part of that process, so that we can begin to, in the future, see the whole process. Because this stuff, it's not going to be all one object normally. It's going to be a series of objects that we're going to have to bring together. Impact of the preservation process. This one, I mean, this is just imperative. We have this. We're going to migrate. We're going to convert. We're going to encapsulate. We're going to do a bunch of stuff to things over time to keep it alive. We've got to alert people to what happened as part of that. Each time there was a migration process, what was the result? What did we lose if we lost anything? Did it come through intact? This is our responsibility to the future. Access and use history. I think there's some of that for security reasons, but I think it could be much more robust for authenticity reasons as well. Okay, finally, preservation strategies. This is just something that's, there's a lot of work being done on this, tons of it. I just don't see it reflected presently in universities. They're just not doing much with all this beautiful knowledge out there, the RLG, NARA, trustworthy. I mean, there's tons of stuff on how to build trustworthy systems. It's making its way into, like, DSpace and Fedora. It's emerging. But I work with the people, the librarians who work on DSpace, and they, frankly, view their repository primarily in terms of access. They don't even sell it on terms of long-term preservation and management, and that's part of the contract we're having with our users. And I sit there dumbfounded that they're missing this important component of it. They're just, it's not there yet. And we all know why. You know, backups when they occur, they oftentimes are gotten rid of after about 10 years or after 10 cycles. If they are retained, they're not migrated for the most part. They sit. These backups are not managed over time. So it's not a preservation strategy. The preservation strategy is one where you put resources, technology, people in place to ensure that this stuff is moved forward over time to new formats, however, whatever your strategy for preservation is. So a part of this will be a process of developing measures and internal controls to measure the integrity of your records. And we've got, you know, a variety of things from checksums on that will help us with that. And these have to be built in. We have to be able to demonstrate that these things have indeed come through intact or not intact. So these are the areas where I think the archivist can make a biggest difference. Is metadata, is audit trails, is preservation strategies in terms of authenticity. You have something to offer, and I can attest to it. I work with auditors, and they have their own responsibilities, and this kind of thing adds value to an analysis of a system. So there's a lot of work to do. There really is, especially in universities, to make these better systems and more authentic systems. And frankly, I worry quite a bit about our ability to authenticate the information of the last 15 to 20 years. It's just, we're not there yet. It's going to create problems not only for us as present-day workers, but definitely for people on down the road. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Phil. That was awesome. That was really awesome. I'm thrilled with this group. You all are just remarkable. I'm Carol Choksi. I'm an adjunct lecturer at Indiana University School of Library and Information Science, and I'm also a records management consultant in my other life. But what most people don't know is that I have a PhD in the history of culture. And so what you're seeing here is actually the real me. The other me is kind of stuck doing other activities. And I'm going to talk about authenticity from the historical perspective, from what we see people in history doing with their documents as well as what we make of them. Multitudinous technological and financial problems with documents and records derive from cultural issues surrounding documents. As much as we might like or not like to believe we live in a secular society, documents hold a special place. Ostensibly, a document is simply captured information that signifies to a human community. A dog's ability to sniff a footprint does not make the footprint a document. The footprint is captured information and it signifies, but in that case not to a human community. A plaster cast of a footprint is a document because it is captured, it signifies, and it signifies to a human community. This is from the definitions of Suzanne Brier and Paul Atlet. If a court case required the jury to go see the footprint on the ground in situ, the footprint on the ground would be a document. It is captured, it signifies, and it signifies to a human community. Just any old footprint is not necessarily a document. No other characterization of documents can do justice either to Paul Atlet's and Suzanne Brier's work or to the rather peculiar collection of objects that I have had to manage, including concrete blocks, pairs of glasses, and so on, as a legal records manager. I've managed bowling ball bags, I've managed corporate seals, and I've also managed electronic and paper documents. The form of the document, however, is irrelevant. What is important is that many documents establish, maintain, and sever relationships. All documents are inputs, outputs, or decision tools in human activity, including stacks, scraps of paper, and DRAM, which is inside the computer. Databases hold information but do not negotiate relationships. A chunk of data from a database may be a document, but the database itself certainly is a document. Ostraca, notepads, and post-it notes are used to hold a piece of information for a short time until it can be acted upon or incorporated elsewhere. I realize this is kind of a blunt proclamation for some very complex cultural objects like the Magna Carta, but history bears this out. We can differentiate how important the relationships established, maintained, and severed are by the type of document. Rome of the Republic and Empire periods published and presented leges and plebiscites documents, laws, treaties, and citizenships to the public as bronze plaques posted on the Capitoline Hill, many in the Temple of Jupiter. This is a bronze diploma from the Getty Museum. We'll go into this a little bit more later. While many could not even be read because of their size, shape, and location, citing one of them required also citing its location. Destroying bronze tablets was not only illegal, it may require forfeiting one's possessions and self to a deity, not through death, but through lifelong service to a god. Other documents, like contracts and accounts, may have been on something more ephemeral, like wax tablets. I think I've even got a picture of that. Yes, there's a wax tablet. This is from the Ashmolean. A more recent and less prosaic example of the value of records to a community is the experience of a company that began as a messenger service in Manhattan and moving on to mail outsourcing, essentially running the mail room for law firms and other companies. Experiencing success in delivering mail, the company expanded to outsourcing file rooms in law firms and the records management consulting services needed to ensure the file rooms worked smoothly. As a consulting subcontractor, I was hired to make recommendations, train, and troubleshoot several file room takeovers. Several corporate managers expressed surprise that taking over the file room was so much more difficult than taking over the mail room. People just wanted to get their mail, but they had personal feelings about their documents. Those personal feelings extend to every aspect of how the documents are organized and managed. Contrast this with changing data in a database. Our expectation is that the data is simply correct. We rarely care whether the database, where the database is or who's handling it. Managing the database requires technical skills, yet getting the box of copied documents out from under the desk of an accounting clerk requires social skills. The Assyrian ostraca receipt, let's see, yes, there we go, is a token of the temporary relationship created by a business transaction. Written on a pot shard, ironically, the receipt will last longer than a contract tablet written on unfired clay. A marriage license is not only a token of one's status as spouse and close relationship with a spouse, but also of one's social standing. For example, contracts are unlike other technological social artifacts, like a hammer or a bed, unlike other symbolic social artifacts, like a flag or non-functional dress, unlike other instrumental social artifacts, like domesticated sheep or shelter. Contractual participants will spend a great deal of time negotiating the price wording, precise wording, referring to precedents, sharing a ritual beverage or meal, and having documents drawn up by professionals, then ignore it within their local peer group. Furthermore, the context for any contract, as with most records, extends backwards and forwards in time and includes so many ceremonial activities that the contract becomes a monument as opposed to a memorial, around which other ceremonies may take place, like the U.S. Constitution. It is this complex nature of active records and inactive records that forces records managers to become experts in the sociology of human organizations and human-computer interaction. The complex nature of documents is exacerbated, of course, by digitization. The simplistic nature of data is enhanced beyond the imagination of computer programmers, even those who played Dungeons and Dragons. Murders are not committed because of a data element. Data elements are snippets of reality carefully crafted to be as uncontroversial as possible. But they are also puzzle pieces. Puzzle pieces by themselves tell us a little, but not a lot. A datum as information is multifaceted so that it can be parsed and joined together with other data in many different ways. Puzzle pieces put together tell us fascinating things, like how many generations it takes for immigrant families to reach an average income. Interpretation of data is an entirely different issue that results in classification. Phrenology and race, which are classifications, is an excellent example of how puzzle piece data are put together to make a picture that becomes controversial. Classification is interpretation that results in a document. Documents are created in a social and cultural setting for social and cultural reasons by human beings with duties and agendas. Records create, manage, maintain, and end social relationships, including cultural, economic, and legal. Documents simply aid records in those activities. Documents are inputs, outputs, and decision tools for human activities. A document changes state to become a record through custom, including cultural, economic, and legal. The intention of the creator of a document plays no role in whether it becomes a record. Only society creates a record. Because records play such an important role in human life, like data analyzed and presented in a report, and documents play the understudies for records, what is contained in records must be supported with commensurate care. And I use the term support a bit like the French use of the term support, which is the underlayment for the information. It's actually a much nicer term than our concept media. A receipt does not need the same support as a deed of land, court decision, or birth certificate, unless it becomes a record through further economic or legal exchanges. Let me see if I've got, here's a nice legal settlement. A receipt in one country will require different support than in another. I was very surprised when visiting in-laws in Jordan to discover that the concept of a warranty that comes with a receipt in the United States is completely lacking in that country, even with the purchase of a car or baby furniture. If you buy an American car in Jordan, there is no warranty, none. One purchases goods at one's own peril. An electronic image of a receipt is acceptable in the U.S. for reimbursement of expenses and for payment and auditing of taxes. Yet I was surprised to discover that the government of Norway required not only original receipts, but the actual boarding pass to demonstrate I had actually made the trip. Recent foreclosure litigation has been stymied by mortgage owners unable to produce the signed original. U.S. executives of European-owned companies complain that parent company executives in Europe will spend years drafting a contract between the two entities, sign it, and then completely ignore it. Conversely, Sri Lankan attorneys representing Sri Lankan tea exporters regularly sue U.S. food companies for breach of contract. We see a sliding scale of whether having an original authenticated document may be irrelevant or the only way to prove a circumstance. The degree of authentication may also be irrelevant. Many mortgage owners can prove ownership in some states by producing electronic copies of originals that have been destroyed. As noted above, pot shards were used as receipts, whereas unbaked clay was used for legal judgments in the ancient world. Because the pot shards were already baked in a kiln, they would survive, whereas legal judgments would survive only if the location in which such records were kept had burned, making them ceramic or buried in dry earth. This is why we have many clay stamps that authenticated papyrus documents in Greece, but few papyrus documents. Fire had destroyed the papyrus and the string that wrapped them and baked the seals. As a normal procedure, Hittite administrators would add writing to a wax board and then seal the board between uses on pain of legal penalty. Authenticity is sometimes confused with media, but not for the reasons research has indicated. As we noted above, media may be mixed. Papyrus, string, and clay are mixed together to create an authenticated document. There we go. So on the right, you see the document with the seal on it. On the left, you'll see it opened up, and you'll notice that the left-hand side upper part is the part that was underneath the seal. There's less of it than the lower one. That's called the hidden part, and the other part is called the open part, and we'll go into that a little bit more in a minute. A document's location may be as important as its medium, as with bronze tablets in the Temple of Jupiter. Have I got a picture of the Temple of Jupiter here? Yes, here we go. The term medium, what the information sits on, gets confused with format, how the information looks. We also realize that the spectacles required to read a medium can make the medium itself, a tape or a disc, nearly irrelevant because we are not reading the disc. We are reading the representation on the screen or the paper printout. English use of the noun form of this term, support, works well with the concept of something that upholds or sustains. This term allows us to include more than just the physical substrate in our understanding of what constitutes our ability to read and authenticate the document. We arrive at our confusion between authenticity and media, quite honestly. Many terms we use for something on which we write are derived from the names of the substrate holding the writing. The word book, for example, stems from German, Old Norse, and Frisian boko, or beach, used for writing all forms of documents. Let's go look at one of those. There we go. That's one of the Vindeland documents that is written on a piece of wood. It's actually the Liber, which is where the word library comes from, which is the inner part of the bark of the tree that's then heated with water and flattened. You can see from the holes that it was actually strapped together. So that's where the word book comes from. Bibliography comes from the Greek biblio, the Greek mispronunciation of papyrus. Tablet comes from Sumerian dub, a clay tablet. Some terms like document and deed stem from what the document is supposed to do or to proclaim or to grant. Others like medium, diploma, or charter describe an aspect of what they came from. So the Roman diploma comes from double, D-I-P-L, and that is because it is doubled. It is then folded in half, and what was on the inside is inscribed on the outside. A charter is a small piece of papyrus. The category records contains items for which worries over authentication are tremendous, like the bronze tablets placed in the Temple of Jupiter in Rome, as well as others over which little concern is expressed, like Mesopotamian ceramic ostraca receipts. History tells us that within cultures that write for business purposes, almost any written claim with some form of attestation for authentication are taken quite seriously by the court. That includes the Middle Ages, all of it. Methods for creating records vary from token to token, support to support, and culture to culture. Knowing the type of record, the support used, and the ceremony required often clarifies references that may appear obtuse. For example, the seven seals of Revelation have produced nearly two millennia of speculation about the seals, what the seals represent, as well as terminology about what is open and what is hidden. So here's an example of how this is actually an Eastern Mediterranean type of papyrus document that you would use for, you might use it for a last will and testament, though the Romans actually tended to use wax tablets. You'll notice in the upper left, the same document, the same writing is up at the top and the bottom. There's a cut. The top is rolled down and then folded over. It's then wrapped with string and sealed with clay, and then the people write their names next to it. So this is called you'll notice there are only three seals. That's because there are three more at the bottom. So this is a six-seal document, and then the whole thing is folded up. You then unfold it to read what it says. To authenticate it, you have to cut the strings and remove the seal. In other words, you have to destroy the document in order to authenticate it, in the same way as the legal document, which has a clay envelope. So knowing what a record looked like in the Eastern Mediterranean at the time Revelation was written is very helpful in understanding what this means. As it turns out, the form of records in the Eastern Mediterranean was rather distinctive for the ancient world. It constituted a papyrus with writing, string, and clay seals. Part of the papyrus was folded up, wrapped with string, and the string sealed with clay, impressed with the seal of an individual or position. The other part of the papyrus might be wrapped around the sealed part for storage. The open part is the formal document, carefully written, using formulae required of the particular situation, and noting the names of each of the parties, as well as the persons who sealed the document, the witnesses. The part that is hidden is normally written in a less careful manner and notes the major features of the open part. The hidden part is opened in case there is dispute over the terms of the agreement. So that's why this one, the upper part, has less, because those are notes and it doesn't have the formulae that the lower part has. The hidden part is opened in case there is dispute over the terms of the agreement. The witnesses, those who sealed the document, will be present to attest that the open part of the document is what they all agreed to, not for the content. The record is closed and sealed with all parties, including the witnesses present, normally with the scribe, sometimes reading the record before it is folded and sealed. Any document for which witnesses can be gathered to attest to the contents are suspect. Note that the Justinian's code is not the same as the 12 tablets. A lot of people confuse Justinian code, which is actually written in Constantinople. Remember, this is a Christian culture. It is an Eastern Mediterranean culture. It is not a Roman culture. They inherited Rome, but they are not Rome. Rome was pagan. It was in Rome, and it had a completely different set of cultural and social and trade relationships. The act performed is the closing and sealing of the will. Added to all of this, the Roman last will and testament was written on wax tablets that were then folded together, bound up, and seals put on the binding. Ceremony for opening the will, however, was ornate, perhaps more so, requiring a majority of the witnesses and a judge or magistrate. In other words, the document did not represent itself. The witnesses represented the document. The law of the Roman will made the assumption that the ceremonies and people at the ceremonies were as important as the document itself. It also assumed that authenticity required human representation. A document could not be authentic in and of itself. Testamentum is Latin for will, suggesting that the New Testament is the new will that supersedes the old, and what is revealed is in Revelation is how the testament shall be authenticated, not the contents of the will. As a heavenly record, it is not for the earthly to know the contents, only that it will be authenticated appropriately at the correct time. The grand ritual befits the requirements of a grand record, the ultimate legacy for humanity. Hence, the open part is what can be read in the New Testament or what John knew to be the New Testament when he wrote Revelations. And the closed part is what was written and witnessed. The two cannot be expected to be the same, and the ultimate magistrate will adjudicate the contents with the help of the heavenly testator. Even the most important record of all time is not self-authenticating. It is authenticated by its witnesses. I shall leave to the divines what that means for Protestantism. What is open and what is hidden also applies to clay tablets, to bronze diplomas, documents giving Roman citizenship to non-Roman soldiers, but not to all records. The concept of a separate duplicate record did continue. A Roman will may have had a duplicate in a temple. Clancy gives examples of the chirograph, in which the town scribe creates two documents on a single page and then cuts the page so the two can be fitted back together again. When we create a contract, we usually sign as many copies as there are parties and give one original to each party. Each record is considered an original, not a copy of an original. Email systems, on the other hand, conveniently or not, place an original in a sent folder so each party has one. Carbon copies are not the norm in history. The creation of two or more originals is. It is the comparison of the two originals by a magistrate judge and the attestation by witnesses that authenticates the documents. Similarly, the location of a record is equally important. Bronze diplomas giving Roman citizens were closed with wire, sealed, and signed. What a soldier had was a duplicate of what was also placed in the temple of Jupiter. Posting there, even in a location that made reading the tablet difficult, authenticated the sealed version held by the newly minted Roman citizen. Moving forward to the 13th century, we find another method for authenticating documents. Notice I haven't said a word about notaries. That's really important. Notaries are actually rare. This chirograph here was never notarized, was never kept by a notary. This was the Anglo-Saxon way of authenticating documents without notaries. Gerard Amalric of Marseille acted as a commercial lawyer for the citizens of his city and the sea captains who put in at his port. He would meet with the parties to the agreement and take notes. He would then write the agreement using the appropriate formulae, making as many as were necessary. He would witness the signing of the document. His normal practice was not to make a copy for himself. But when a disagreement arose as to the contents of a specific agreement, his notes in his folder were considered dispositive. He did not keep an exact copy, nor serve as a records repository for his clients. Precise duplication was not used for authentication, nor were hidden and open portions written on the same document. Until very recently, an oath was required as part of the creation process for records in the United States. This was only done away with in 1928. We find verbal oaths about records throughout history from the earliest court records in Sumeria. Normally, the oath speaker places his or her hand on an important or precious object, such as a symbol of a deity or a Bible, to emphasize the importance of the process or ceremony. Despite the best efforts of cultures to create good processes for authentication, courts have adjudicated the issue throughout the millennia. Authentication is a process for society's acceptance of a record being what it is, but not always for the record saying what it says. What do we do when a token arises without its process of creation being clear or having anyone to attest to a claim the society should accept it for what it is? That's when we go forensic. That's the only time we go forensic. Forgeries are rife throughout history. There are recent forgeries of ancient records, like the scandal over Solomon's tablet, allegedly from 1000 BC, a description of repairs to the first temple. Modern forensic methods found the tablet to be a forgery, raising questions about every other artifact purchased within the preceding two decades in Israel, lacking a clear provenance. Provenance must go beyond chain of custody to the process or ceremony of creation. Archivists and records managers are not the arbiters of authentication. The courts and forensics experts in the employ of courts are. What authenticates one document may not authenticate another. What records managers and archivists can do is to detail the processes and ceremony by which records and documents are created, in addition to tracing carefully the chain of custody. problems in creating a process to authenticate electronic records and electronically stored information are not different from those in authenticating any other type of record or document when a support changes. As it has frequently done over the millennia, what is distinctively different is the technological and social changes over the past century, when business records could be created and copied in greater and greater volumes without ceremony or need for two originals. The invention and commercial success of the typewriter in the late 19th century meant that huge numbers of documents could be created quickly and look close to identical. The typewriter was the printing process of the business world. The acceptance of inexact copies of first gel presses and then carbon copies meant that the copy retained by the organization was not a near duplicate or a handwritten duplicate, but a clear copy that is not the original. Mimeographs and copiers made the ability to give each employee their own copy. The volumes and duplicates of ESI are simply electronically stored information. That's what the courts are calling it. Are simply the logical extension of this trend. The methods we use to manage paper, like copy control and distribution control, don't cease to work. Those methods must simply be applied to electronic records and documents as well. Thanks.